You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome everyone to the SmartCast Microlearning podcast series on alopecia areata, hosted by Med Learning Group. My name is Kia Jones, Medical Director at Med Learning Group, and I will be the host for today's podcast. This is the first of two podcasts in the series titled JAK Inhibitors and Alopecia Areata, How to Use in Varied Clinical Scenarios. Today's podcast is geared more toward our non-dermatology clinicians who may encounter patients with alopecia areata, and it will focus on JAK inhibitors and the rationale for their use in alopecia areata. Joining me today is Dr. Amy McMichael, Professor of Dermatology at Wake Forest School of Medicine in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Welcome, Dr. McMichael. It's so good to have you with us today.
Hi, Kia. It is my absolute pleasure to be here.
Awesome. So, Dr. McMichael, there has been quite a lot of excitement going on in the field of alopecia areata lately, with the first systemic JAK inhibitor, baricitinib, receiving FDA approval for adults with severe alopecia in June of last year, and the second JAK inhibitor, ritlecitinib, receiving approval less than 4 months ago for patients 12 and up with severe alopecia. For a non-dermatologist audience, can you start off by explaining what alopecia areata is and how it's diagnosed and some differential diagnoses?
Of course, I'm happy to do that. Alopecia areata is a little bit confusing to folks who are not dermatologists, mainly because alopecia is in the name. So a lot of people think that alopecia areata is just hair loss of any kind, but alopecia areata is a very specific form of hair loss that we consider to be an autoimmune form of hair loss. In other words, it's genetically determined, and there is a process, an immune process, where your body thinks that some part of you is foreign and decides to fight against that. Other autoimmune diseases would include certain kinds of thyroid disease, like Hashimoto's thyroiditis, diabetes is thought of as an autoimmune disease, Crohn's disease, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus. There are many forms of autoimmune diseases, and alopecia areata is one particular form of autoimmune disease that affects the hair. And typically what happens in alopecia areata is you get patches of hair loss. So very distinct, round, circular patches of hair loss. And they can actually occur anywhere, but we usually talk mostly about the scalp when we're talking about treatment. But certainly you can have these on the beard of a man, on the face. You can have hair loss on the body. You can have eyebrow, eyelash involvement. And interestingly, alopecia areata can also affect the nails. It does it more so in children where they have pitted changes in the nails. But anyone with very active disease can have that. When we think about alopecia areata, we can also think about mild, moderate, and severe disease. It sort of blurs when we talk about patients and their psychosocial health when it comes to their hair loss. But when it's a patch that comes and goes and it's very small and easily covered, many people are not bothered by it. They don't even come and see the dermatologist because they say, oh, I have another one of those patches again. Now, when they have moderate disease and they have to come in to see someone to get treatment, then it starts to become a problem. Treatment can consist of many things that take down inflammation, because at the end of the day, what we're talking about is a situation where white blood cells attack the hair follicles and basically put them to sleep. They don't kill them off. They don't cause damage, permanent damage necessarily, but they do put them to sleep. And we think that that happens as a result of the loss of something called immune privilege. So that's where your body normally doesn't let white blood cells into the hair follicles. It usually protects you from having this attack. But for some reason, the genetics, this autoimmune process allows white blood cells to get into the hair follicle and actually attack it. So we see it in about, there's a lifetime incidence of 2%. In the population, at least in the U.S., 160 million people globally are thought to have this. And it is seemingly more common, as we're seeing in epidemiologic studies, more common in women. and in people of color, at least in the U.S. data. So we have a lot that we've learned about alopecia areata in the last, I'd say, 5 years, although many of us have been studying alopecia areata for decades.
Right. Oh, that is really, really interesting. And thank you for explaining that so well. You mentioned that alopecia areata is an autoimmune disorder. Are there potential triggers that can initiate a flare? You know, is this something that people can do to avoid, you know, aggravating it?
Well, you know, with autoimmune diseases, I think that, you know, they're kind of interesting in that they can just kind of start up and end when they want. And that's one of the most frustrating things about alopecia areata is that you can be just living your life, happily going along, nothing really is happening, and you'll get a flare where it could be very mild, moderate, or very severe, where you can have, you know, totalis or total hair loss of the scalp, or even universalis, which is total hair loss of the body. Now, there can be times when the body is physiologically stressed, for instance, a surgery or general anesthesia, a motor vehicle accident, you know, something of that nature, where your body does have a tendency to maybe have a flare in those times, but there's not always a identifiable trigger. You know, people like to think about stress as emotional stress as being sort of the cause of hair loss. And I'm not sure where, you know, in our history of disease, this sort of stress and hair loss association began, but it's very strong in terms of what people think is happening. But we really don't see that anymore in alopecia areata than we do in other diseases. For instance, if you're prone to headaches and you have a stressful time, you don't sleep well, you're not eating well, you know, perhaps something emotionally is going on, you may develop a headache. Now, the headaches aren't caused by the things that are going on in your life, but you might develop one because you're, you know, genetically prone to get them. You know, same for back pain. Your back pain may get worse, or you may have a stomach upset, or you may get hives, but those things are not caused by the stress. And in that same way, alopecia areata really isn't caused by stress. So we don't want to perpetuate this idea that if you just lower your stress, you know, you can kind of treat alopecia areata and make it go away. It would be great. And if any of us had a fail-safe way to treat stress, I think that would be certainly something that I'd be willing to buy, but no one has that yet.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Because, you know, even I have heard that misconception of, you know, hair loss being associated with stress. So yeah, thank you for, you know, kind of clearing that up for everyone. So now that we've gone over what alopecia areata is, let's talk about treatment. Up until recently, there, you know, weren't many effective treatment options available, especially for more severe cases. Now with the arrival of JAK inhibitors, I imagine this has been, you know, a significant game changer for your patients and for your practice in general. But before we dive into that, can we talk a little about the pathogenesis of alopecia areata and the role of JAK-STAT signaling?
Oh, absolutely. It's one of my favorite things to talk about and think about. You know, we, for a long time, you know, knew about this sort of swarm of bees, we like to call it, white blood cells coming up to the hair follicle in the deep dermis and, you know, sort of attacking the follicle. We could see it, you know, we could do biopsies and we could see it under the microscope. We see all these little white blood cells. And we knew they were T cells, you know, sort of swarming around. But we didn't have a lot of understanding of exactly what was going on there. Several researchers, you know, looking at both mouse models as well as humans, have been able to sort of decipher down that what is actually happening is that there has to be, in order for this to happen, you of course have to have that loss of the immune privilege. But once that happens, we see this ability for the T cells to sort of make IL-15, and once that happens, the secretion in the follicular epithelial cells recruits and activates more cytotoxic T cells, and then it sort of becomes a whole cycle of just constant revolving of the follicle to the natural killer T cell, just kind of ongoing inflammation. So once the cytotoxic T cells come there, they start to secrete interferon gamma that binds to its receptor on the hair follicle cell, and that leads to further secretion, and so it goes. And as we know, this all works through the JAK-STAT pathway. And so, as do other disease processes. And so, we've sort of been learning about JAK-STAT over the last couple of decades, but we didn't know its role in alopecia areata. You know, we knew that it was playing a role in rheumatoid arthritis. And this is why now we share that drug, baricitinib, a JAK inhibitor, with alopecia areata. And this drug was used for many years in rheumatoid arthritis before we recognized that JAK-STAT was the real key player in alopecia areata. So that's really the thing to understand, is that there's white blood cells, there's loss of the immune privilege, so the white blood cells can get in. The process of the IL-15 secretion starts to interferon gamma, and all that works through the JAK-STAT pathway. And so that's why our drugs, these JAK-STAT or JAK inhibitors, are working so nicely in our patients with alopecia areata.
Wow, that, it's really fascinating to learn about the science behind this condition. Thank you very much for that wonderful explanation. How have these new agents impacted the way you care for your patients with alopecia areata?
Well, it means that I'm a lot happier at the end of the day. That's what it means. And I think the patients are as well. What I can do for patients who have moderate to severe disease. And the reason I say moderate, even though I know that the indication is for severe disease, is because a lot of our patients who have moderate disease by measurement, we use something called a SALT score, which is an assessment of how much alopecia areata is occurring on the scalp. When we use the SALT score, we can sort of indicate, okay, this person is moderate by the measurement. But what we can't measure with a SALT score is if their eyebrows or eyelashes are affected, or if their psychosocial life is being affected significantly. And now we have actually published a paper that shows that when you have a psychosocial impact that's severe, eyebrow and eyelash involvement that's severe, or you have just unremitting hair loss that just isn't stopping, they sort of boost you up into the next category. So if you were mild, having any one of those boosts you into the moderate area. And if you are moderate, having any one of those boosts you into the severe category. So for my patients who are moderate to severe, those who get boosted from moderate to severe, or who are severe in measurement with that SALT score, I can now offer them something which is going to give them, an excellent chance of regrowth. Things that we had in the prior time before JAK inhibitors, worked about 35% of the time. And unfortunately, that wasn't great for our patients. Now we have things that, really do a wonderful job with regrowth alone, and can be actually combined with other things when we have just patchy growth that's remaining, or patchy loss that's remaining. So it's changed the whole approach to what we say to our patients, how we think we can do with their hair growth. It doesn't mean that every single patient is going to do well with the drug. And obviously that's never going to be the case, but it does mean that I'd say 80 to 90% of our patients have cosmetically acceptable hair at the end of the day, if we use JAK alone and combine it with our other modalities of treatment.
Wow. That's truly, truly exciting. And, being able to provide more options for your patients, I have to imagine that's extremely rewarding for you. So for our non-dermatologist listeners, let's say an allergist or an immunologist or a primary care physician, what are some considerations regarding JAK inhibitors in alopecia areata that you think would be important for them to know?
Well, I think it's important for them to understand that the patients want this treatment. They are clamoring for a way to be in the world in the way that they feel comfortable. It is extremely uncomfortable being a 17-year-old girl and not having any hair. Now, there are people who are very well adjusted and, you know, make the most of wigs and scarves and hats, etc. But being so different from your peers is really a horrendous way to have to spend your teen years. And for adults, it can be even just as upsetting, you know, having this constant, you know, hair regrowth, hair fallout, hair regrowth, hair fallout. You know, you never quite know where you're going to be on the spectrum of disease. And that makes it very difficult to live a normal life. Well, today I need a scarf. Next week I might not need a scarf. Next month I might need a scarf. You know, you don't know what to think and how to even treat your disease because it's so constant and chronic, but in a way that makes it difficult to cover. So I think for our other practitioners, getting them to dermatologists early is the key. There's also data that shows that the earlier we treat alopecia areata, the better you do. So rather than sort of wait until they're of a certain age or get to a certain stage, have folks come into dermatology early on and get assessed. And if they're appropriate for treatment, we can get them started on JAK inhibitors sooner. So I think those are the key messages. I think that we also have to work together because, you know, as I talked about, there are autoimmune diseases that are very similar to alopecia areata, but our alopecia areata patients sometimes have those other autoimmune diseases. They tend to be overall healthy people, but when you see one autoimmune disease, you may see another. And the other thing that we see a lot in our patients is atopic dermatitis or the sort of atopy framework. And so these patients may have asthma, they may have atopic dermatitis. And so for our allergists, for our pediatricians, our primary care practitioners, we need to work together to get these patients under control. And there is actually data on some of the on several JAK inhibitors now in psoriasis as well as in atopic dermatitis. So we're making inroads into our ability to treat patients not just with one disease but with multiple diseases.
Wow, those are all really excellent points, and you know, very insightful, your conversation. And thank you. We've definitely learned a lot today. Yeah, hopefully we can, you know, get back together again and talk about, you know, some of the other exciting things going on in alopecia areata. So yeah, thank you. Thank you, Dr. McMichael, for your time today.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would like to also give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Lily, who provided an educational grant for this activity.